I'm very pleased to be here. I haven't changed the order of the lectures, by the way. You'll be happy to know. I thought I'd start, I mean, I don't know what brings you all here, but with a story. One never quite knows how to get started, but there's a story, probably apocryphal, as so many of these are, from fairly early 20th century when a man named Al Smith was the Democratic governor of New York. He was actually a presidential candidate a little later, if you know your history. But as the story goes, anyway, is it humming? Is it, you know, am I doing something? Or no? Okay. The story goes that when he was the Democratic governor of New York, he would give talks at various places, of course, and one time he went to give a talk. At that time, Sing Sing was the only maximum security prison in the state, and he went to give a talk there to some of the inmates at the penitentiary. And he got up there to start his talk, and he suddenly realized that he didn't quite know how to begin, how to get started. Often when he'd give his talks, he would just begin by saying something like, "My friends." But he didn't know if that was quite the right way to start. Sometimes he'd just say, "My fellow Democrats." But, you know, that didn't seem quite right either. So finally, after one of those sort of pauses that probably isn't as long as it feels to the speaker, he just looked out at his audience and he said, "I'm so glad to see you here." As I am to see you, not entirely a captive audience, I hope, but anyway, I'm glad to see you. Let me just say a word just to put this talk into relation to the other two. I think that the overall theme that we agreed on was something like perspectives on death and dying or something like that. In this first talk, I want to just talk about several different ways of thinking about death, not just Christian way, but several other ways, though moving toward a Christian way. In the second talk this afternoon, I'll take up what I guess you might think of as more practical questions about decisions at the end of life. We have a lot of hard decisions to make in the world we live in about treatments and treatment refusals and so forth, and I'll try to think through how we ought to make those and think about them. And then in the talk tomorrow morning, I'll try to give some, I'm working toward the more theoretical background, thinking about the understanding of equal human dignity that underlies that Christian view that I'm working with. So that's where I'm headed. After committing myself to giving this series of lectures, I found myself thinking as I was putting it together, and actually again this morning as I was looking over what I wanted to talk about, I found myself wondering whether it was not a bit morbid for me on such a nice day to be giving several talks on the subject of death and dying, especially to an audience, many of whom are, at least by my standards, relatively young, therefore, for whom it might not seem to be quite so pressing a concern. And yet, of course, this student generation, the generation that I teach, is one that whether it wants to or not, or likes to or not, is going to have to give a good bit of thought to questions of aging and dying. As I always tell my students, they're the ones who have to bring me my meals on wheels someday. At least I hope somebody will do that. And if you pay even the smallest amount of attention to the news, you know that the question of how we will care for and finance caring for an increasingly aging population is very puzzling. And it's a burden that the next generation will have to take up. Now, I'm not going to be telling you in these lectures how best to do that. Indeed, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure who does really know it. But I will be trying to think with you a little bit about what it means for human beings to grow old and to face death. And the more seriously we've thought about these matters, even if we don't always get clear answers to questions, the more seriously we've thought about it, the better prepared we are to face those problems when they arise, even if what we're facing turns out to look like hard and even unanswerable questions. So forethought is needed here. Epictetus, great Stoic philosopher who was himself a slave in Rome, Epictetus wrote, Let others study cases at law. Let others practice recitations and syllogisms. You learn to die. Now, that's a sentiment that is probably especially characteristic of a Stoic, but something like that is the way philosophy was actually understood in the ancient world. And philosophy was not thought of as a discipline. We think of it as something entirely separate from religion, but it was a way of life. And as a way of life, it was also an, what was called an ars moriendi in the medieval period, an art of dying, learning the art of dying. Socrates clearly understood it that way. If you read the dialogues about Socrates, he's always worried about tending his soul and learning how to do that. There was a man, I believe he's dead now, Admiral James Stockdale. Don't know if that name rings a bell for most of you or not. I find that for my students, when I use him as an illustration, if he rings any bells at all, it is unfortunately when he was Ross Perot's running mate on a third-party ticket back in the 1992 presidential election, and was a fairly old man who did not do real well in the nationally publicized debate. If they remember anything, they remember Admiral Stockdale from then, which doesn't do justice to the man. He was a naval flyer, was shot down over Vietnam, was a prisoner of war for a long time, something like 7 years or something like that, and was the highest-ranking naval officer in captivity. And as the highest-ranking officer, he actually got a lot of special attention from his captors, though not the sort of attention that that one would normally want. And he said later, after he was released, that he endured his captivity by remembering his reading of Epictetus. Now, anything that can do that for you is has something to be said for it and is worth paying attention to. So we can think a little bit about learning the art of dying, as Epictetus says. And the first question you might ask yourself is, how would you like to die? We don't get our choice, of course, but still we have preferences. And I think it's true that a rather large number of people in our society today, if asked that question, how would you like to die, will answer very quickly with one word: suddenly. We want to die quickly. Now, in part, this means that we don't want to experience a long, drawn-out suffering, and that is surely understandable. In part, it means that we don't want to have to live with declining capacities, whether physical or mental, and that's also probably understandable, though actually I think a bit more complicated. But so we have one popular image of how best to die. We want to live at the peak of our powers for as long as we can, and then just fall off the cliff suddenly. That's what many in our world would like, and actually probably many of us in certain moments would find appealing. Another image, somewhat like it but also different, that's quite popular, though a little less easy to describe, is what often gets called a natural death. Lewis Thomas, who was he's also died in recent years, was a physician essayist, wrote some wonderfully elegant essays about medicine and society and so forth. Lewis Thomas, in one of those essays, offered a nice image of what it would mean to die naturally, as he thought. He used a poem of Oliver Wendell Holmes. The poem is about a carriage that was made by a deacon. And Thomas uses it to distinguish between a life that breaks down and a life that just wears out, what he thought of as a natural death. In the poem, the deacon fashions this carriage of his with such care that it's a kind of perfect organism, each part as good as all the rest, with no weak links. Had there been a weak link, and had that link broken down, then the carriage might have halted, so to speak, prematurely, before its time. But instead, since it never breaks down, the whole thing just gradually wears out. As the poem puts it, a general flavor of mild decay, but nothing local, as one may say. And then finally, one day, it just goes to pieces, all at once, nothing first. That's Thomas' picture of a good death, a natural death. Again, a picture, I think, shared by quite a few people in our world. If we can't have the best of all worlds, to just live indefinitely at the peak of our powers and then suddenly fall off the cliff, then this kind of natural death, we think, might not be too bad. Disease would not take us prematurely before our time, though I find that the notion of what a premature death would be That's a moving target. What it seemed to someone at 50 is not what it seems to that person at 65. But the notion is, anyway, the disease would not take us prematurely. We would not break down in any way. We would just gradually wear out. And in his essay about this, Lewis Thomas says of such a death, "No tears, no complaints, no listening closely for last words, no grief, just in the way of the world, total fulfillment." Maybe, but we might wonder just a bit about that. No grief, total fulfillment. Now, Thomas does say in the way of the world, and I'm not sure what he means by that qualifier there, but a lot depends on what we think the way of the world is. A lot depends on what we think a human being is, what the human being's place in the world is, whether we think human beings are only finite creatures, sort of made for passing joys and made to wear out finally, or whether we think that human beings are sort of strange, two-sided creatures, finite to be sure, embedded in this world, but also in some sense transcending it, also in some sense free of it and made for something more. And you can think of what I'm going to do in this lecture, and what I'll, in some ways what I'll do in the other two lectures, is sort of exploring in more detail that vision of human beings as strange, peculiar, two-sided creatures. Now, for starters today, in this lecture, what I want to do is just try to depict briefly three attitudes toward death that have been important in our history. The first of them will bear some similarities to that notion of a natural death that I think appeals to quite a few people today, Lewis Thomas' idea. It'll be a little different as well. But I simply wanted to pick these to appreciate each of them in a way, though it will be clear that I think finally the third of them is where the greatest truth lies. And in order to try to depict them, I'm going to use three stories, good stories, I think, to illustrate them. It might help if you happen to have read the stories, and I'm sure that many of you will have read at least one, maybe two of these stories, but it's not really necessary. You don't have to have read them in order to understand what I'm talking about. Now, before I start on the first one, just a very brief digression for the sake of my wife, actually. There's an English word, EGG. You might just pronounce that word to yourself. Think how you say that word, EGG. I'm going to need to use that word a number of times in describing in this first story and talking about it. And I'm going to say egg. Okay, not egg, egg. It's a function of sort of where you grow up and so forth. If my wife were here, though, it would drive her crazy. She would take it as a sign of questionable education, I think. This is my apology at the start. That's the way it's going to come out, and you're just going to have to kind of live with it along the way. So then, in Charlotte's Web, by E.B. White, we read about someone who dies alone but also lives on in her offspring. I'm sure many of you know the story. Charlotte is an exceptional spider whose affection as a friend and talent as a writer has saved the pig Wilbur from becoming ham and pork chops. Wilbur has even been judged a prize pig at the fair. When the fair is over and preparations are being made to return to the Zuckerman farm, Charlotte tells Wilbur that she's not going to be going back with him. She won't be returning. Having created her masterpiece, her egg sack, with 514 eggs, she knows that her strength is spent and that she will soon die. Now, Wilbur is panic-stricken at the news, but he does manage at least to take that egg sack back with him, carrying it with him in his mouth. And as Wilbur is being loaded for the return trip to the farm, Charlotte whispers goodbye to him, content in the knowledge that her children are safe with him. And the story says, she never moved again. Next day, as the Ferris wheel was being taken apart and the racehorses were being loaded into vans and the entertainers were packing up their belongings and driving away in their trailers, Charlotte died. The fairgrounds were soon deserted. The sheds and the buildings were empty and forlorn. No one was with her when she died. Now, in that description of death, you do get a certain sense of sadness, surely, kind of drabness almost of death, the loneliness of it. I mean, it's a powerful picture in a way of what death is for, well, since we've humanized Charlotte for a human being. And we might ask ourselves, therefore, what else is there in the story? What, if anything, is there in the story for us to set against over that, over against the loneliness, sadness, drabness of death? And in this story, there are, I think, two things that we set over against it. The first of them is friendship. When Wilbur wonders why Charlotte has done all this for him, spinning those webs whose messages won for Wilbur his reputation as a prize pig, you remember, those of you who've read it, you know, some pig and all those webs that she spun. When he wonders why she did this, Charlotte responds by pointing out to him the reciprocal benefits of their friendship. "You have been my friend," replied Charlotte. "That in itself is a tremendous thing. I wove my webs for you because I liked you. After all, what's a life anyway? We're born, we live a little while, we die. A spider's life can't help being something of a mess, what with all this trapping and eating flies. By helping you, perhaps I was trying to lift up my life a trifle." Now, if you read this as more than a book about spiders and pigs, what you can detect here is a certain vision of life. It's a vision of life, actually, that I think is Aristotelian. Just that E.B. White is probably more fun to read than Aristotle is. But what sort of a vision? Well, caught up in the messiness of life, in search of a brief flourishing before we are replaced by others essentially like us, we are most ourselves when united in a bond of friendship. Together in such a bond, we achieve a certain kind of nobility and excellence. We flourish as the beings we are. And that's worthwhile, even if it ends finally in that sort of drabness and sadness of death. That's one thing in the story that's very powerful that we set over against death. And the other thing is nature, the cycle of nature. The cycle of nature is greater than we are. And in its own way, it offers us a chance for a certain kind of survival, a certain kind of victory over our mortality. Wilbur has been saved from that premature death at the hands of a butcher, not so that he may never die, but so that he may live out his life in full, not die prematurely, so that he can live it out in full, as Charlotte has lived hers out in full. And Charlotte, in turn, then lives on in her children, in her offspring. Wilbur, you remember, has taken that egg sac back with him, and one fine spring morning, the little spiders begin to crawl out. Most of them, to Wilbur's dismay, float off on the warm spring breezes. But three of Charlotte's daughters stay behind to live in the barn and be his friends. And although Wilbur always remembers Charlotte with a certain kind of special fondness and affection, he's very greatly pleased with his new companions. Charlotte herself has not exactly survived, but her life has pointed beyond itself through the continuation of the species, and her willingness to wither and die, her willingness to live out that cycle, has given rise to the next generation. And in that sense, she lives on, and death doesn't have the last word in the story. Something like that is the point of the story. And again, it is, I think, very powerful. That's one way to think about death, a way that, as my reference to E.B. White, as my Aristotle suggests, is a way that's actually very deep into the history of our culture and our way of thinking. But there are other ways to face death and to think about it. And Charlotte's Web is not the only children's book that will bear many readings. Another one, the one that probably fewer of you will have read, is Felix Salten's Bambi. I don't know how many of you read it. I'm not talking about having seen the movie, okay? These are two different things entirely, the Disney movie or this story. Bambi was translated into English by a man named Whitaker Chambers. Only a few of you who are at least 50 years old or older probably are people to whom the name Whitaker Chambers will mean anything. A rather significant man, mid-20th century, had tangentially something to do with the rise of Richard Nixon in our political life. Wrote a book called Witness. It's an extraordinarily powerful book. I mean, Whitaker Chambers would be worth knowing about. He's the translator. And the preface to the English translation of Bambi was written by John Galsworthy, himself a reasonably well-known novelist. And in the preface, Galsworthy refers to the book as a little masterpiece, as I think it is in its own way. And if E.B. White is my Aristotle, then Felix Salten is Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius. It's a great Stoic, and Bambi, I think, is a very Stoic book. It's part of the reason why young boys like to read it, I think, at a certain age. But anyway, the story of Bambi is really primarily about one thing. The young deer, Bambi, is gradually taught by the old stag, never named, just he's the old stag, he's gradually taught how to live wisely. And if you say, what does that mean? Much of what he learns has to do with death. So that Bambi sees the ferret kill a mouse, and he wonders why. He learns that they can play in the meadow safely only after dark. It's a hard lesson to learn, an important lesson to learn. He watches the leaves begin to fall slowly from the trees. There's a chapter in the book, a short chapter, but a chapter in which the only two characters, the only two speakers, are two leaves, the last two leaves on a tree. And I want to read you just the last part of that chapter, the conversation between them. It goes like this. They were silent for a while. Then the first leaf said quietly to herself, "Why must we fall?" The second leaf asked, "What happens to us when we have fallen? We sink down. What is under us?" The first leaf answered, "I don't know. Some say one thing, some another, but nobody knows." The second leaf asked, "Do we feel anything? Do we know anything about ourselves when we're down there?" The first leaf answered, "Who knows? Not one of all those down there has ever come back to tell us about it. Let's remember how beautiful it was, how wonderful when the sun came out and shone so warmly that we thought we'd burst with life. Do you remember? And the morning dew and the mild and splendid nights. A moist wind blew, cold and hostile, through the treetops." "Ah, now," said the second leaf, "I..." Then her voice broke off. She was torn from her place and spun down. Winter had come. This is not just a children's book. I mean, it's a children's story, but it's not just that by any means. Well, gradually Bambi's mother leaves him alone more and more. He misses her, and missing her, he sort of wanders through the forest, calling her by name. And on one such occasion, he encounters the old stag for the first time. It's the first time he meets him. And the old stag asks, "What are you crying about? Can't you stay by yourself?" And what the old stag teaches him then, not just on that occasion, but gradually over time, is that he must act bravely and still more that he must learn to live alone. And that doesn't just mean physically alone. It means psychologically alone. The story says, when he was still a child, the old stag had taught him that you must live alone. Then and afterwards, the old stag had revealed much wisdom and many secrets to him. But of all his teachings, this had been the most important. You must live alone if you wanted to preserve yourself, if you understood existence, if you wanted to attain wisdom. You had to live alone. You can understand how Admiral Stockdale might have been helped by such a philosophy. Now, of course, the problem is that by nature, we don't necessarily want to live alone. I mean, Charlotte and Wilbur don't want to live alone. There are emotional ties that draw us to others, and drawn by them, we may be helped in various ways. That's the angle that Charlotte's Web takes. But at the same time, we cease to live within ourselves. And when we cease to live within ourselves, we become vulnerable. One day, Bambi thinks he hears Feline calling him. She's a young female deer. And he thinks he hears her calling him, and he's overcome by desire to be with her, and he just goes crashing through the forest, paying no attention to caution or carefulness or anything like that. And suddenly, as he's just kind of crashing through the underbrush, the old stag is there in front of him. The old stag always moves very silently. You can't even hear him, you know. I mean, he's just his woodcraft, or whatever we'd call it, is remarkable. But he's suddenly there, right in front of Bambi, barring his way. But Bambi really isn't thinking about anything else. He wants to get he's frantic to get to see Feline. And he tries to persuade the old stag to let him go. The old stag doesn't want to. The old stag insists that she isn't calling, and it isn't she. Old stag actually uses excellent grammar, you might know. He knows a predicate nominative when he sees one. But anyway, Bambi insists on this, and so finally they strike a kind of bargain. The old stag leads him, takes him very cautiously by a roundabout way, slowly, until from the safety of cover they see a hunter imitating the call of a deer. That's what Bambi was heading toward. And the lesson in the story is a very clear one, even if a kind of hard one in a way and painful. Bambi is most vulnerable when he does not live within himself, rests his heart in anyone outside himself. And in the story, the dangers and the hardships of life just become occasions for learning how to live, how to face death. And only those who learn flourish. There's another deer, Gobo, a male deer Bambi's age, who, when he thinks of winter and the difficulties of finding food, says, "It must be dreadful." To which Bambi responds, "It isn't dreadful, it's only hard." But Gobo had actually been cared for a while by a hunter. He'd been shot and wounded, not killed, just wounded, and the hunter had taken him to his lodge and sort of nursed him back to health, not because, I mean, there was no altruism at all, just wanted this deer to grow up and get antlers is what he had in mind. But eventually he had released Gobo, and Gobo had returned to the other forest animals, sort of congratulating himself on his special relationship with human beings now, at least so he thought. It had been the old, when they were standing, some of these animals were standing around talking, it was the old stag who suddenly, silently, you know, just sort of appears suddenly, who noticed the halter still around Gobo's neck and says, "You poor thing." Gobo had not learned to live within himself, to use the hardships of life and the death to which it leads as a training in virtue. And lacking that sort of wisdom, he could not really face death with a kind of inner tranquility. The point of the story is that if we want to learn to die, we must learn to live in such a way that death cannot touch us, that it cannot finally harm us. Now, that's another and a quite different way of trying to overcome death from Charlotte's Web, though also with deep roots in our history, so that a way of seeing to it, once again, that death doesn't get the last word, or there's a kind of victory over it. This way, too, has an undeniable nobility about it. I always feel, when I teach the Stoics, what I think about it depends a little bit sort of almost on what side of the bed I got up on in the morning. There's power to this. In certain moods, though, you may regard it, and perhaps rightly regard it, as inhuman in certain respects. And yet, this, too, is a way we've had of facing death in our tradition. But there's yet another way, a third way. And for this, I use another story that I'm sure a good number of you will have read, C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle. It's the seventh in the series of Narnia Chronicles. Many of them are good stories in different ways, and many of them relate to this theme, The Last Battle is the one that is most clearly relevant to what I'm trying to think with you about today. This story, as you will know, probably recounts the end of Narnia. The glorious land of Narnia that, you know, those other six stories have taken you to comes to an end here. And the loyal Narnians and the children from our country who've gone there to be with the to help the loyal Narnians all end up in Aslan's country, finally. That's where they end up. Now, if E.B. White is, for me, Aristotle, Felix Salten is Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius or somebody like that, then Lewis here is St. Augustine. This is and Lewis is very Augustinian, I think, and this is a very Augustinian book, The Last Battle. But it's a story that moves toward death every bit as insistently as any one of our lives moves toward death. You know it, I mean, if you're paying attention, you know it from the very start of the story. The first words of the first chapter of the book are "In the last days of Narnia." Now, you might just kind of read it, you know, as you go along, but that's where we're headed. That's where the story is going. The first sentence of the second chapter introduces Tyrion, last of the kings of Narnia. And the characters in the story all know what Jewel the Unicorn, who's a sort of dear friend of King Tyrion, they all know what Jewel the Unicorn says, puts very succinctly. Jewel says, "All worlds draw to an end except Aslan's own country." So if we thought our world wasn't going to draw to an end, if we thought Narnia wasn't going to draw to an end, we would be deceiving ourselves. We have to know that from the start. All worlds draw to an end. What's a little different in this story from, say, Charlotte's Web or even Bambi, is that the fact that all worlds draw to an end is not simply a natural process. It's not just that the fires burn out finally. And in that sense, it's a little unlike the other two stories, because ultimately the fact that all worlds draw to an end is the will and the work of Aslan, that great lion who's the ruler of Narnia, son of the emperor beyond the sea and all that sort of thing. And more particularly, when night falls on Narnia, and that's the title of one of the last chapters of the story, when night falls on Narnia, it's not just because of the second law of thermodynamics, you know, that everything runs down. It's because Aslan says, "Now make an end." And if that's the reason why we move toward that end, why it comes to an end, then however exactly we feel about it, we cannot simply protect ourselves against it. The pain that emotional attachment brings has to be risked in a way out of love for the goodness of Narnia. And when Narnia is no more, and the children have made it into Aslan's world, if you know the story, they end up through that stable door into the stable, into a world that turns out to be bigger on the inside than it was, and so forth. They end up in Aslan's country, where the refrain is further in and further up. They continue kind of going farther and farther. But there's an interesting exchange here, and it's an exchange that's worth our thinking about when we think about sort of living toward death. And when I read this exchange, I always think about the peculiarities and the difficulties that Christians have in thinking about heaven. You know, you want to go to heaven. Right now? Probably not. Do I really want to go to heaven? And how am I supposed to think about that? This is a good life that we have. I'd rather like a little more of it, however good heaven may be. And so it's part of that two-sidedness of our life. We don't know quite how to think about this. On the one hand, we struggle and struggle to stay alive. But then if I die, everybody tells my wife he's in a better place. We don't quite know how to deal with this. But the one thing that we may not do finally, I think, if it's the Christian story that we're living in, is we cannot be simply stoic about it. Certain pain must be risked because of attachment to this world that is God's. And so you get this exchange between the children from our world who come to help the Narnians when they end up in Aslan's world. It goes like this. "So said Peter, night falls on Narnia. What, Lucy, you're not crying with Aslan ahead and all of us here? Don't try to stop me, Peter, said Lucy. I am sure Aslan would not. I am sure it is not wrong to mourn for Narnia. Think of all that lies dead and frozen behind that door. Sirs, said Tyrion, the ladies do well to weep. See, I do so myself. I have seen my mother's death. What world but Narnia have I ever known? It were no virtue but great discourtesy if we did not mourn." It's a great exchange, and an exchange that we might ourselves try to remember at Christian funerals. So much of what we say probably doesn't come quite as close to the truth as "it were no virtue but great discourtesy if we did not mourn." That Christians need to do. But it's a complicated vision of life because, after all, they are now in a better place. They're in Aslan's country. That's also true at the very same time. So that in this story, like Charlotte and Wilbur, the Narnians have found much to delight in and cherish in their world. There's a great deal that's good there. It's not just something they have to steel themselves against or try not to learn to love too much. No, there's a great deal that's good there. One ought to love it. But unlike Charlotte, knowing that all worlds come to an end except Aslan's country, The Narnians cannot find sufficient meaning and purpose in life simply in the succession of generations, simply in the sense that the next generation comes along to take our place. Because all of that whole succession of generations leads finally just to an end, when Aslan says, "Now make an end." So that in this story, a succession of time and generations, however long extended, however, you know, many cycles nature takes us through, that does not finally offer everything that the heart desires. It's good. It's to be enjoyed and treasured and mourned when it's lost, but it doesn't offer everything that the human heart desires. What we could say is that it offers what you might call quantity and continuance, more of the same. And I don't mean that in a bad way. More of the same that's very good. But ultimately, what we desire is something that is not just quantitatively more, but qualitatively different. That's the claim, anyway. And that's what makes the story, I think, so Augustinian. This is, I mean, you shouldn't just read The Last Battle. You should read Augustine's Confessions also, which famously begins with the line about how our we're made for God and our hearts are restless until they rest in God. This is Lewis giving us a kind of narrative depiction of the restlessness of the human heart. And so what that means is that even if we were to overcome aging and dying, we wouldn't have achieved the goal. We wouldn't have achieved what it is that the human heart really desires. Because to be with Aslan is not just a longing for more of this life, however wonderful it may be, even that delightful Narnian life. It's something different, something qualitatively different. Now, you could also say that in a certain sense, the old stag realized that. He's no Aristotelian. The old stag doesn't think that just the cycle of generations that goes on is that we can kind of be content with our part in that. He doesn't think that at all, but having seen that that's not enough, he's driven to conclude that any other desire of the human heart is ultimately in vain. You see, that it won't be fulfilled, that we're sort of vain and futile beings in a way, and that therefore we must protect ourselves against those desires, that we must not attach ourselves too greatly to the beauty of this world and the delights of companionship that it brings. So he sees something but draws a different conclusion than a good Narnian draws. What The Last Battle offers us, by contrast, is a story that invites and legitimizes our attachment to this world, accepts the pain that such attachment may bring, and does not pretend that death is not dreadful in many ways. It pictures creatures who are finite, whose hearts are rightly tied to particular places and persons. It does not reconcile us to death quite as much as either of those other stories does. It leaves us caught in the midst of that two-sidedness, having to kind of live in both worlds, in the delights of this world and with a certain kind of unanswered longing for another. But it pictures creatures who desire something that is like the country of Aslan, qualitatively different, where you go further in and further up, where there's a kind of inexhaustibility that is not just a repeat of the cycle of nature, but something more. That's Lewis' explicitly Christian vision. He certainly does draw it from Augustine, though he gives it probably there's more delight in some ways in the image that he gives us. But Augustine himself thinks the very same thing when he asks himself in Book One of the City of God why it is that we shouldn't just baptize people and then dispatch them. After all, they'd go to heaven then. You know, I guess we'd have some complicated discussions about baptism here, but let's just not worry about that. Augustine asks himself why we shouldn't just baptize people and kill them. You know, they end up in the better place then. He says, well, no, but a way must be traversed, you see. A way must be lived to that. We're caught somehow in that relation between those two worlds, and that's what The Last Battle is about. It is an explicitly Christian vision of death. It will therefore, I think, be a little more complicated and a little more puzzling than either of the other two. It is, in a certain sense, somewhat less straightforward than either Charlotte's Web or Bambi, because it doesn't seek to say just one thing about death. It always, you always have to say a couple different things about death. It's a great evil, and yet it brings you to Aslan's country. Those complications and those puzzles make for a complicated way of thinking about death and about the end of life, and it's those complications that I'm going to be thinking about, or some of them, not all of them by any means, but some of them in the next couple lectures. In the second lecture this afternoon, I'll try to think about how this, what I've called this sort of strange two-sided picture of human nature, teaches us to think about the decisions that we make at the end of life or struggle to make. And tomorrow I'll try to think through some of the conceptual underpinnings, the theoretical underpinnings that that grow out of that, the complicated kind of nature that we have. But for the moment, it's enough to say that we have, wholly apart from the kind of simple images of death that we live with in our culture, we have three images here very deeply into our culture, each alluring in its own way. I mean, it's the third that seems to me finally to be the truth, but I do not wish to underrate either of the other two, which in their own way are powerful and have something to teach us. But in the end, all worlds draw to an end except Aslan's country, and we have to learn how to live in the light of that. Thank you very much.